welcome to another edition of the Gobeski Wallace Report. I'm Adam Gobeski.
And I'm Charlie Wallace. Today we have with us five guests who will wait their turn and when they're addressed to respond, or else this will descend into chaos.
I don't think much of our guests.
We have to keep them in line, yeah. We've got Paul Wilcox.
Thanks for having me.
Amber Elby.
Hi again.
Dan Hess.
Present.
Kevin Vredvog.
Hello.
And Doug Gobeski.
That's me. And we're here talking about our 16th sci-fi shuffle movie. This one was a pick from Amber, and it is the 2006 film V for Vendetta.
So for a little...
That's so all I got.
Yes. Amber, why are you making us think about these things today?
Yeah. So I chose this one because I try to watch it every year around November 5th, given that that is a major part of the film. And this year, I lost the opportunity to watch it on election night. I should have done that. And then the next day, I had regrets for not watching it. And so I watched it on November 6th. And I had a big response to it emotionally. And that's why I wanted to make you all go through that same kind of experience. So I'm sorry for dragging you through this. And also, you're welcome.
Well, you had to watch it twice in close succession, apparently. So
I did. I watched it with different members of my family. Well, I guess the first time I watched it by myself. And then the second time, I roped my husband and 16-year-old into it. And my 16-year-old had not seen it before and was very skeptical that it was, in fact, an old movie and kept on asking, wait, when did this come out? it feels very present if you're unaware of its release date.
So if I gather correctly, you kind of consider this to be like the VHS from the movie The Ring, where you just have to keep showing it to people. Just like pass on the trauma.
Yes, and like the VHS in that movie, I do have a physical copy of this as well, which I don't for everything. But this felt like a movie that I was, I have concerns that it may not exist online in perpetuity. So I wanted to make sure I have it on Blu-ray.
They'll just abridge it like they did It's a Wonderful Life, I recently learned.
Wait, they did?
Yeah, last month Amazon posted an abridged It's a Wonderful Life that cuts out the entire portion where George Bailey learns what life would be like if he had never been born and how everyone's lives were changed. It apparently goes from Clarence going, I still need my wings, to George running through the town.
What?
What? Seems like an important part of the movie, but I guess I'm not a streamer.
Are you sure this wasn't an Onion article?
100%. Because it came up on Team Trivia yesterday, and I had to look it up to go, what?
There's no way. You're breaking my brain here.
See, I thought you were going to go the other way with that and be like, they just unearthed a 17-hour version of It's a Wonderful Life. Turns out we've been watching the abridged one the whole time.
I think that's a Rick and Morty joke.
Oh, oh yeah.
Man. I should check that show out.
V for Vendetta is the story of a person named V, codenamed V, pseudonymously V, who is trying to enact his vendetta against people. The end. This is a near future dystopian England run by ultra nationalist party, and V is against this and promotes public terror and revolution. And meanwhile, Natalie Portman gets roped into this inadvertently, and then we can discuss her journey as part of the podcast.
And it is an adaptation of a graphic novel, also called V for Vendetta, that is by Alan Moore and David Lloyd. And that came out much earlier. And also, I do want to say that the screenplay was written in 2004. And the screenplay is significantly different than the film. It has a lot of differences.
Yeah, we're going to save any comparisons between the movie and the graphic novel for the DC movie spree. Instead, we're going to talk about V for Vendetta more from a science fiction movie context. How does it perform as that kind of movie? And just as a movie in general, how well does it work or not work, depending on everyone's opinions? So I guess Amber kind of kicked it off a little bit, but let's just go around real quick and continue with whether we'd seen it before or not. I saw it in theaters when it came out. And then at one point I bought a used copy of the HD DVD, which I did not watch. And when I tried it out the other day, like most HD DVDs made by Warner Brothers, it had completely bronzed and was unplayable. So I had to watch it on Amazon rental to switch. So that was the second time I'd seen the movie.
Similarly, I watched it, 19, 20 years ago? I don't recall.
I'm pretty sure it was last year it came out.
I don't recall if it was in the theater or like shortly after it came out on video. I feel like it was in the theater, but I honestly don't remember for sure. But I hadn't seen it since, and I too had to rent it on Amazon Prime, though luckily I had some of those Amazon Prime credits from allowing things to be delivered on like all at the same time, 3 days later kind of thing. So it was free, but I did have to rent it.
It was long enough ago, I don't remember for sure. I either saw it in like honest to God movie theater, or for those who went to Michigan State, I think Wells Hall used to play like movies like 5 or 6 months after they were out of theaters.
They did.
Yeah, I may have caught it there. And then I think, like Amber said, for a couple of years there, I also was watching it around the 5th of November every year, certainly through undergrad. I probably fell out of the habit sometime between undergrad and whatever period of time has passed since then. And yeah, this was probably, you know, watching it yesterday, the first time I've seen it in about a decade.
Yeah, I don't remember the conditions under which I watched it. I would have put this squarely.
The conditions.
No, I don't know at all. Like, I would have put this squarely.
Was I forced?
In, like, undergrad, if I had to guess, but it didn't come out until after I was already graduated. So I have no idea. I have seen it. That's all I know.
Yeah, not to be old, but this came out when I was in grad school. And the reason that I referenced the script is because we read the script as part of one of my classes, as one of my adaptation classes. And so I did see the movie before I read the script, but I'd forgotten the movie, I think. Or at least the script was so different that when I read it the first time, I was like, this seems not that good. And then like when I saw the movie again, I was like, oh, it's better. Because the script is in a weird order. Like it starts with front-loading exposition. And I like how they changed the order of things in the film.
So this was my second time watching it. I own it on a widescreen DVD.
What? I thought you had a full screen.
No, sadly, it turned out to be a widescreen DVD. So got it at a garage sale and watched it, I don't know, like a decade ago, maybe.
I think I watched this. I definitely saw it probably somewhere in the 2006, 2007 undergrad time for me. Not in the theater, but at least a couple times on DVD afterwards. Probably a Video to Go rental or something along those lines to keep it local.
Nice.
Out of curiosity, I mean, is this the first movie that everybody has seen going into it already? Usually we have somebody who hasn't seen the movie yet.
Yeah, somehow, yeah, I think it is.
Yeah. And yet, hey, we have the most guests.
I feel like the Wachowski siblings were a very, very big deal at the time. So maybe.
Yeah, I think this would have been.
It was the it movie to see.
This was like the first thing they did after the Matrix trilogy had finished.
Was this pre-Speed Racer or post-Speed Racer?
This, I believe, is pre-Speed Racer, post-Matrix Revolutions.
Okay. So, yeah, because I know that, like, Agent Smith is V, right?
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering, maybe we all saw it because it was like the movie to go see when it came out. I remember it being a big deal when it came out.
Yeah, and I think it had a lot of positive buzz. It wasn't one of those movies that was like, oh, you know, feel free to skip it or whatever, right?
I approached this somewhat through the script. It was something that I studied when I was in grad school because it came out when I was in grad school, just to be a little bit old. And as you said, it is tied to The Matrix. It's by the Wachowskis, as you said. And they went on to write Sense8, which, if you like this kind of science fiction vein that they tend to exist in, that's a series that I would recommend. And this one is dark. Like, did you all think it was darker than The Matrix, or did you find it more uplifting?
It's an interesting question. I don't know. It's darker more, at points, but
it's more realistic. Like, I can imagine the world getting to where it is in V for Vendetta a lot easier, current AI trends accepting, than where we get from where we are now to The Matrix. I mean, The Matrix, you know, the reality there is extremely upsetting, obviously, but there's it almost feels quaint that this came out in 2006, as has already been briefly addressed. Like, it's upsetting to know that 20 years later, like, this feels more relevant than ever, and sensing the reality in it does kind of make it feel worse than watching The Matrix, say.
Watching this, there is no blue pill. And like, it's a real testament to, you know, how much maybe things have changed in the last 20 years or whatever. But like, I don't remember this movie giving me the like sort of emotional reaction 20 years ago when I saw this. Like, I didn't remember much about it. I remembered it was, you know, kind of an alternate reality. V is inspired by Guy Fawkes. He's mad at the government, blows up buildings, etc. But like, it didn't really register or sink in until I watched it this time, and it was like borderline traumatizing. The Matrix felt very sci-fi to me. It felt very like another universe almost. It's an interesting idea. This felt like I was watching it. It didn't feel fun. But it probably did 20 years ago. Right.
So that, I think, brings up a more general question that I want to touch upon, which is, do you think this really counts as science fiction?
According to the robots that now run Google, it is science fiction. So I don't know.
Well, let's get actual human interpretations involved rather than AI potential hallucinations.
So prior to recent events, like when this came out in 2006, it felt like science fiction. It had the element of like a future catastrophic pandemic that brought chaos upon the world. It has a superhero that is created through science that is rooted in the past, but his abilities evolve in a very sci-fi kind of way. So it has these elements from like Mary Shelley, so like Frankenstein with this superhuman that's created through science, and then The Last Man, which is about, I don't recommend The Last Man as casual reading in the post-pandemic world, but it is Mary Shelley's apocalyptic work about everyone dying in England, except for the one guy who lives. So I would say that it felt more sci-fi, as I said, when it came out. I think it's moving more into, unfortunately, realistic fiction in a lot of ways, especially when it has things like newspaper headlines of what happened during a virus outbreak. And we can sit there now and be like, yeah, this is really kind of what happened. So
when we went, sorry not to interrupt, but when Doug and I were watching together, like the headline came up of like 80,000 dead, and Doug was like, that's it.
I literally thought the same thing. I was like, that's nothing.
So yeah, it is one of those things, like The Veldt by Ray Bradbury, when that short story came out, we were all like, well, I wasn't alive, but not people alive, I imagine. Yeah. Yeah, they're like, future home, house that can do stuff. That's really high tech. And then my 13-year-old read it in school, and she was like, a lot of this stuff is real. So, you know, it what once was science fiction crosses into the real world thanks to technology, or in the case of V for Vendetta, thanks to societal collapse in some way.
So that brings up an interesting question. So as someone who has, you said you watch it like every year, versus someone like in my position who saw it 20 years ago, forgot almost everything about it, and then watched it again 2 days ago. Every year when you watch it, have you seen it creeping closer and closer and closer to going from like speculative fiction to like a weirdly predictive documentary?
So I don't think I watched it actually during the pandemic. I think I skipped a couple of years in there because I knew it wouldn't be fun to watch. But I remember before that being like, oh, well, like queer persecution, that's not going to be a thing that happens in the future. We're going to go the opposite direction and have more inclusion in our society. And yet here we are. So when I do rewatch it, I kind of think like, oh, well, we won't have to loot the museums and hide like important paintings in catacombs someplace. But now I'm thinking like maybe we'll get to that point. Like maybe we'll have to throw Botticelli in a basement someplace to save it from government censors. Like who even knows?
Okay, so that's one point of view regarding science fiction. Did anyone have an opposing or just maybe a different point of view?
I think it works. I think just because of the origin story for V, if that story wasn't in there or glossed over, like we don't get into it, then it might be hard to justify that. But yeah, it's like genetic engineering and superhero.
Genetic engineering.
Yeah, I thought they were just using people as guinea pigs to test out bioweapons. Oh,
there was something about
this guy
genetics.
Happened to just randomly be able to survive it.
Oh, yeah.
Well, they explicitly stated it enhanced him in certain ways.
They did?
Something like kinesthetically. I don't remember what word they said.
Yeah,
there was like one or two throwaway lines. That, by the way, was my cop-out answer, that because science magic made him a superhero, technically sci-fi.
Yeah, I thought that's what led to like why he could throw people like almost through a brick wall.
Oh, yeah, that's
and
true.
Was
that
super
happens.
Fast and all that kind of yeah. stuff. Yeah.
I just assumed it was his rage.
He was very calm.
So the reason I kind of asked the question is because there is a debate of sorts in the larger community as to the differences between what counts as science fiction versus something like an alternate history, things like that. Do those count? A lot of times this gets classified under a general umbrella term called speculative fiction, I think in part so that the initials SF don't have to change.
History is not a STEM degree, thus alternate history, not science fiction necessarily.
And these are dystopias too. So like The Handmaid's Tale would fall into this category, and that's usually grouped with science fiction. At least I taught it as part of a high school sci-fi class that was assigned to me to teach. And they were like, teach The Handmaid's Tale. So I did.
Although Margaret Atwood disagrees with you, but
would you actually find
the
Handmaid's
Tale? The science fiction label and prefer something more closer to speculative fiction.
Would you find that in the sci-fi section at a typical bookstore?
No, I think that's
not that that defines anything, but I'm curious.
I think that's probably in the now a major TV series section.
That's a separate table.
It's got that Netflix thing that looks like a sticker, but is printed right on there.
Yeah.
But seriously, I think all Margaret Atwood stuff is in the regular fiction section, isn't it? Does she have anything in the... Like if you go, I mean, my frame of reference is like Barnes and Noble, but
I feel like speaking from the same perspective, I would say most like a lot of speculative fiction, unless it has a strong sci-fi element, yeah, would end up in general fiction, not in any kind of genre fiction.
I have to confess, I've never attempted to buy a Margaret Atwood book at like a Barnes and Noble. I think the one time I bought one, it was that student bookstore assigned to a class. So.
I found those, and also 1984, in the quote-unquote literature section of half-price books, where I think they just kind of throw everything. Like, the literature section is the biggest section.
I buy most of my books at used bookstores, but I do like to wander around and browse at Barnes & Noble. I find it relaxing. So I'm just trying to picture where I would have seen them.
In the manga section...
that's the one that's in, wrapped in the plastic.
A chibi Handmaid's Tale.
You don't.
It's in the plastic. Oh.
So going back to V for Vendetta, have you all watched any sci-fi movies that take place in England
like
apart from this one?
For the shuffle or in life?
For the shuffle, I mean, hopefully you have in real life, but...
Yeah, offhand, I don't see anything in the official Gobeski-Wallace Report shuffle that is set in England, unless I'm misremembering something.
So the reason I asked is because this one draws quite heavily from English history and holiday traditions. Like, did you feel like that alienated you from this, or do we share enough in common with our brothers and sisters and siblings across the pond that that doesn't matter?
I found it strange because my understanding is that the gunpowder plot is not celebrated as like an awesome thing that almost happened. Like, people aren't being asked to remember the 5th of November because it was so close to being sweet, guys. You don't know how good it was.
It would have been fireworks, literal fireworks, right, in the sky.
So there are like huge fireworks festivities in England. And I think it was more referring to like the joy that's associated with the holiday is more like the modern celebration of it. Those of you who are unfamiliar with English celebrations like this, look up the town of Lewes. It's L-E-W-E-S and their bonfire night traditions. They have like the biggest celebration in England. So shout out to my friend Alice who lives there. They have big torch parades where it's not like a torch, like a flashlight. They are actual torches that they go out at night and like wander the streets. And they do, of course, have bonfires and fireworks. And they also have effigies that they burn that are usually like political figures or pop culture figures. It's a seemingly unique celebration. Like, as an American, I feel like it's different than what we do. And it does have this kind of overall feeling of rebellion that is something that's reflected in the movie and associated with Bonfire Night.
But for the longest time, the effigies were of Guy Fawkes that were being burned. I'm not sure, as an American, watching this movie made by Americans, how I'm meant to feel about V's interpretation of Guy Fawkes. Is that supposed to make me not on his side? Am I supposed to just be like, oh, wow, that sounded cool, I don't know anymore? I'm not sure how much I, the audience member, am meant to know.
The very beginning of the movie, and really just contextually through the rest of the movie, Guy Fawkes is made out to be a guy who was doing a good thing. And knowing absolutely nothing of the history, like, was he in the right? Was, you know, everything horrifically tyrannical in the 1600s or whatever? Or was he actually a really horrible person who was, you know, I guess saying right and wrong in any of this doesn't quite fit, but, you know, should we be looking at him as a hero, as V seemed to, or is that supposed to be making us feel differently about V's motivations? Because with the exception of that, and obviously, you know, killing people is bad, I'd say the movie definitely makes him out to be more of a positive freedom fighter than, say, an anarchist.
So let's just touch really briefly on the gunpowder plot. Basically, in the wake of Henry VIII splitting from the Catholic Church so that he could get divorced, Catholics underwent persecution in England, partly because the crown was concerned that the Pope was trying to basically overthrow them and reinstate Catholicism in England. That started to be a bit lenient under James I, but didn't go as far as they wanted. So a bunch of Catholics, led by a man named Robert Catesby, devised this plan to blow up Parliament. Guy Fawkes is the figurehead because he was the guy guarding the barrels of gunpowder when they went to look in the House of Lords after they'd been tipped off that there was a plan going on. They were, perhaps unsurprisingly, caught, executed rather horrifically. I believe they were hung, drawn, and quartered. And they probably set back the cause of Catholic emancipation by at least 100 years. So not super successful from their point of view, but it did give the country, I think, something to rally around, at least at the time.
And there is a drunk history version of this, if you would like to see a visual reenactment. But one interesting thing that's become a theory in recent years is that Shakespeare, William Shakespeare, may have been in Parliament that night, like doing other things, and had Guy Fawkes and his comrades succeeded, they would have blown up Shakespeare, and that would have sucked. I had to remind my 16-year-old of that at the start of the movie. I paused it, and I was like, these guys almost blew up Shakespeare, and then carried on.
Where in his writing career, though, like, what would we have gotten, and what would we have not gotten?
Well, we wouldn't have gotten The Tempest for sure.
Or Henry VIII.
Yeah. There would have been, I don't know, when would it have fallen?
I don't think he'd written Macbeth yet, because I think, aren't there arguments that Macbeth is partly inspired by this and a similar plot earlier?
Yeah, I think so. That makes sense.
Not sure where Hamlet is. I think Hamlet might be after this.
Hamlet is. Hamlet has a range.
So you're welcome, Shakespeare, for inspiring Macbeth.
Yeah.
Do you mean you're welcome, Guy Fawkes?
No, Shakespeare should be thanking Guy Fawkes.
Oh, sorry.
Guy Fawkes should be saying you're welcome for inspiring you.
Oh, I gotcha.
Let's dig them up so they can have this conversation. Come on, guys.
But
we should reenact the Between Two Ferns between Guy Fawkes and Shakespeare.
But I think because Guy Fawkes is more an English villain than a hero, traditionally at least. Yeah, it makes me really uncertain about how I'm supposed to treat V in this movie, because a lot of the movie and what it shows us of V is largely at cross purposes with that initial impression that the movie gives us. In that, like Kevin said, he is more like a freedom fighter than a terrorist, let's say. Or at least that's how the movie chooses to depict him, romanticize him, however you want to phrase that.
I did expect a little bit more ambiguity about, all right, is this guy doing the right thing? Are we supposed to be on the side or not? I think the movie, for the most part, is like, yeah, no, this guy kicks ass.
Yeah, and it aligns him with the Count of Monte Cristo, like this kind of person who got screwed over and imprisoned and then tries to seek his revenge in the same way that V is doing by killing off the various people who are involved in his creation.
In the opposite of his defense, and while I agree, the movie does show, it at least seems to indicate that what he is doing is an absolute positive thing. He does torture Evie for no reason. I mean, he's definitely made out to be an enormous asshole, but, you know, kind of a lovable / heroic / saves the country one. I mean, but they definitely don't skirt around the fact that, you know, just even accepting that we as a people are weirdly okay with heroes just murdering other people, like, he still did torture this person for weeks, ? Like,
months, maybe?
Very hard to defend that particular move, and it does help put at least a little bit of gray on the character.
Yeah, I totally agree, because like I had the same thought watching. It was like he seemed like the hero until that, and then I'm like, I don't know how I feel about him anymore, because she seems like brainwashed and, you know, Stockholm syndromed now, and I'm not sure that I'm on board with that. Like, it definitely seemed to sort of contradict the way that he had been sort of framed up until that point. Even then, when you look at the people he was killing, those specific targeted people, evil though they may be, it was very personal. It wasn't necessarily like for the good of the country. It was like, you were on that board of directors, I'm going to murder you. Like, it was very personal.
I mean, I think one thing to keep in mind that is that the movie is called V for Vendetta, right? Like, there is a vengeance thing going on here.
True.
Amber, you at one point brought up like the screenplay version, and I'm wondering how different it was beyond like structure, because to me, rewatching the movie and also just having this discussion, it feels to me like the script and the visuals are telling slightly different stories, in that the script seems to be, I think, a little bit more ambivalent about V and his actions, but the visuals show it as like, oh, he's doing these cool things. He's a superhero. He, you know, stops the bad guys or whatever, right? Like, so I'm wondering if that's something that was in the screenplay that maybe got sanded down, or if it's just I'm kind of reminded of the I think it's Francois Truffaut who said something along the lines of, it's basically impossible to make an anti-war movie because anytime you depict war on screen, because it's so naturally cinematic, it looks cool. And people are like, oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. So the script is much more Evie's story. Like, hearing you talk about V and how he's the hero, part of me is like, but Evie's the hero. In the script, she's a sex worker. And that may be something for you to consider later when you talk about the comic as well. But it starts out with the kind of exposition of V's origin story, and it's all told through voiceover in that. And it is Evie who's saying it, just like Natalie Portman's voiceover is used somewhat later, like when that backstory is revealed. But actually, now that I say that, it's not. The story of Valerie is told by a different actor, but that was originally told as an Evie voiceover. So, like, she is more central in the script. And I think she's more central than we're giving her credit for in the movie. We see her before V. We hear her before V. She outlasts V. She says essentially like the final important words of the film. So I've always had a bit of a problem with the posters and some of the ads, because they so much center the character of V, and she's kind of off at the side and is presented as a love interest. It's weird that that's how they chose to present it, because I mean, it's Natalie Portman too, and she's super cool. And why wouldn't she be the hero of this thing when she's been in episode one prior to this? So yeah, I like her and I like the character.
But I think that's kind of what I'm getting at, is that like visually, I think the movie invites us to be much more curious about V than we are about Evie, right? So we keep getting like drips and drabs of his backstory as the police investigators like learn more about it and things like that. And so I think in some ways we're invited to treat Evie as like nothing more than a love interest slash eventual co-conspirator or something. But it's not clear to me how willing a co-conspirator we're meant to think she is. And I think we kind of lose Evie's character as a character because she becomes a lot of more or less an audience surrogate for a large part of it.
She almost comes off as more of a victim throughout a lot of the movie.
I'm not sure I picked this up the first time I watched it, but she's threatened with rape twice, at least in this movie. Like first being attacked in the alley by the fingermen, right? And then with the bishop, yeah.
I mean, she goes through the, whatever, the hero's journey. You know, she comes into this situation that's out of her comfort zone. She grows from it. In the end, with her making the decision to send the train to blow up Parliament, I mean, she certainly has agency there. But even that agency is basically gifted to her by V. It bare minimally, he's the, I don't know, Captain Jack Sparrow. Whether or not he was actually the main character of Pirates of the Caribbean or whether it was Orlando Bloom, I don't know, but he's certainly the character everyone left talking about. Or hell, Hannibal Lecter. I mean, you wouldn't say he was the main character, but for a guy with like 15 minutes screen time, it felt like he was the co-main. I hated the love arc. Like, I just,
yeah,
it did not feel like something that needed to happen. It was weird, especially with the whole, he literally imprisoned her. Hell, it was weird with the ambiguity that straight up V could have been her dad, who was in the same like facility that V came from and lost all of his memories. I did not enjoy that they were romantically attached to one another. I mean, I could see versions of this where it's less romantic and more just a whatever kinsmanship, but that is the one element of this movie that I just don't care for. And 20 years ago, I probably was, they're going to get together and I love it. But now I just, blech, I wasn't a huge fan of that.
Was that love angle present in the screenplay?
I don't remember. I was trying to remember that so I could chip in, but I will give you a Gen Z perspective. My 16-year-old also found it cringy with the opening sequence with Guy Fawkes's hanging and like making that into a love story.
Yeah.
And then when Evie kisses V's mask, my kid was audibly like, no. And
I am on board with your kid because I felt the same way.
And we were talking about it afterwards, and I was like, so Evie was supposed to be a sex worker according to the original story. And my kid was like, that would have been cooler. Because there's this idea that sex workers are powerful and are taking like control of their own lives. And my kid is also like the number one cabaret fan. So that probably influences this perspective, but I like to see how the younger folks who didn't see it when it originally came out take it. I appreciated those hot takes, especially about the beginning, like framing the whole thing as a love story when it's like actually an execution that's being portrayed. That was just a weird disparity between like the portrayal of the emotions and the visuals.
All of it just felt like a producer's note. Like, hey, this needs to be about romance. And like, it just kind of got injected into the plot. Because without it, the story still works perfectly well. I don't know. And even from, as you said, the very opening, Evie is the character that talks first. And what she is talking about is, did anyone really think about how much this lady must have loved Guy Fawkes? Like, it's just a weird way to frame the story from my perspective.
One minor correction. Her dad is not said to be in the same place V is in. He was held at a detention facility. Yeah, his was called Belmarsh.
Oh, I had that switched up. I might just double checked
because I also was like uncertain. So
I can't. I know we're not talking about the comics. That may have been from there. That's maybe where I got that mixed up.
Oh, fair.
Probably one of the few like negative notes I had in the movie was the love story angle that seemed to come in late and just was like, wait, what, was that necessary? But as we were talking, I thought more and more like. And that's why I asked the question to Amber about the original script, because like it felt like a producer's note. Like the studio came in and said, actually, these two need to fall in love. Make that happen. Reshoot a couple scenes if you have to, but those two need to fall in love because that's what people want to see, even though really it's not, right? But it sounds like the kind of thing a studio would have thought.
Yeah, and there's measurably less love, like romantic love, in films and series now. They've actually done studies with Gen Z. They don't want to see people getting together in like a sexual or romantic way. They want to see groups of friends doing stuff. And the example that I love of producers actually listening to them is there was apparently a kiss at the end of Twisters that was used in some of the promotional material, and then it was cut from the end of the film because they were like, let's not make this a love story. It's about people chasing tornadoes. And I think that there could be a cut made of V for Vendetta that removes some of that romance that would play better now with our current
situation. I completely agree. I totally agree. Yeah.
Gen Z ruining everything.
Hey, Seinfeld was ahead of the curve, man. They refused to let Jerry and Elaine fall in love. No, Larry David, he was going to go to his grave if he had to.
I mean, they do have
Gen Z hates Seinfeld, so what a shame.
There is the episode where Elaine and Jerry hook up at the end of the season, but.
Yeah, but that was a middle finger from Larry David to the producers because they kept saying they have to fall in love. And he said, I'm going to defiantly have them have casual sex and not fall in love. I listened to a lot of the commentaries back in the day.
No, that's fair. This has been your Seinfeld update. Paul, you've been kind of quiet over there. What are you thinking?
I didn't realize that Twisters had like its own Sonic the Hedgehog moment. Like, fix the movie before it came out.
They had to redo the CG because the movie ended with them kissing in a tornado.
You can kind of see it like shimmers a little different, like where they kind of blurred out the background rather than, you know, use some AI infill.
I had one question, and it's directly addressed in the movie, but maybe just the depth of it, which could give a little bit more, you know, at least some subtext about whether V is a good guy, bad guy, or manipulating literally everyone. They talk about the coincidences a lot. I mean, from things, you know, as you know, tiny as that Dietrich made almost the exact same meal for Evie as V had made, down to literally what he says, to more major things like, you know, all of the people who were involved in this, you know, hush hush government experiment had been killed. When, oh man, I don't remember his name, the main cop, the main detective.
Finch? Is that right?
We'll go with Finch. When he's kind of doing his spiel where he said he felt like all of this was connected as part of a pattern, and it showed things like up to and including Diedrich throwing out his approved script and burning it with his cigarette. Like, how much was V planning of everything that happened. I mean, was him finding Evie, who was perfectly suited both in her history and her access, was that truly a coincidence? Like, has he been planning this out to this minute level of detail, up to and including her betraying him and running to the person that he expected to, you know, do his show differently and get this revolution, you know, more and more rolling? Like, how much control did V have over everything that was happening from everyone's perspective?
The only thing I can speak to, they did have the scene where they're looking at the footage where V is pacing around Evie and trying to decide whether to take her or not. So that's the only thing where at least the evidence he's left behind suggests that he didn't know he was going to take her initially.
Fair.
I guess for me, I kind of took the Gordon Dietrich stuff as maybe V giving people like him permission to react against the government a bit, or feeling like they had that ballsiness, I guess, for lack of a better word. And obviously that backfired fairly catastrophically for him, but you know, I think it's a sort of a sense that like the government doesn't have as tight control as they want after V's initial video.
And yeah, I completely agree. For Dietrich, it backfired horrifically, but it did further V's intentions. I mean, you know, people at that point were already starting to doubt whatever ridiculous stories about how all of these big names were dying. I'm sure that had an equally significant effect on, you know, folks that were tuned in. Like I said, I guess I just, because they dwelled on the coincidences so much, and because even in like I said, the minutia, the literally made breakfast identically down to the like, I don't remember what he said, like bonjour, mademoiselle. I mean, not that I'm claiming that V somehow planted it in his mind to say that. I just wasn't sure if the movie was trying to guide us into a place where maybe truly from start to finish, V was manipulating everything, or if it was just a fun thing that they decided to throw in to let you mull over the exact question I'm asking.
It's a fun thing slash an example of what they said at the end, which is that V is all of us.
Sure.
That scene definitely confused me at the end, though, when like he, like they're unmasking eat like themselves, and like one of them's like the police lieutenant and another one's like Gordon, and I was like, wait, I thought he died. Did he not die? And then they showed like other characters who were dead. I was like, oh, this is a metaphor thing. Okay. But I was definitely confused for a second.
It was weird because they told instead of showing, and then they showed instead of telling the metaphor, and I don't know, it didn't feel like you needed both. I think it could have stood without Evie monologuing about how he's all of us. I think it would have been maybe a little bit more powerful, the imagery, if they just kind of let it stand without being explicitly stated why all of these dead people are taking their masks off.
I don't think people would have understood that it was a metaphor.
I suppose that's fair.
You would have had,
he brought them back.
I'd have been.
You would have hit, yeah, you would have had a bunch of think pieces about what does it mean? Like the end of Inception, you know?
Did you want V to take off his mask? Because my 16-year-old literally goes, take off your mask. Like,
no.
Subway.
Absolutely not. No, I want it like a Judge Dredd thing where you never see the face.
Yeah, I like the silhouette. I like showing him as a silhouette with the fire.
I feel like we should take a moment to actually talk about the performances in this, because we haven't really talked about like the fact that Hugo Weaving is having to do this entire performance wearing a immobile mask, or, you know, what Natalie Portman's doing, stuff like that.
I was going to ask that. Is it Hugo Weaving? Like, did he actually do the acting in addition to the voiceover, or was it like a... Okay.
So it was initially a guy named James Purefoy, and then he left the project after about, I think, 6 weeks. I don't know exactly how, but they brought in Hugo Weaving afterwards. And fortunately, because he's under a mask the whole time, Hugo Weaving could just redub the voice part. But some of the physical stuff is Hugo Weaving, but some of it is still James Purefoy.
Huh.
Okay.
That felt less weird in a post-Mandalorian world.
Yeah.
That is... That has made this seem much more standard than it was before that. It just teaches you to look at the actors differently and in their movements. Because I remember the first time I saw V for Vendetta, I was like, oh, I just want to see his face. Like, I need to see facial expressions. But then rewatching it more recently, it's like, okay, I can see how he's moving. And that's how I'm going to watch the character.
He did start out with his plethora of V's speech. And I was like, this is going to get a little exhausting. I hope this is all we get with this.
But I liked it. You're using only V words the entire movie. Yeah.
And he says, oh, wait, hold on, stop. Wait a second. He gets out his thesaurus and he's like, Vivisection. How can I use this?
Vichyssoise. All right. And of course, the great late Sir John Hurt as the fascist leader. I kind of wondered, given how Big Brother he's generally depicted in this movie, if that was deliberate, given he played Winston Smith in 1984, back in 1984.
Mm.
If that was like part of the reason they cast him as sort of an irony thing.
An interesting thought for sure.
It's a pretty cool arc to have as an actor.
Become the thing you hate.
Well, that's the thing now for actors to play villains in their older age when they played heroes as younger folks, like with Hugh Grant.
Hugh Grant's been the hero in everything he's ever done. Thank you very much.
Or the opposite in Hugo Weaving's case, right? Like he was Agent Smith, and then right after that, he was now he is the revolutionary.
You forgot the elf man in the middle there.
Yeah, so it was a transition, yeah.
Elrond?
Yeah.
Lord of the Rings?
Oh, yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, don't get me started on that.
So curious now.
Oh, you heard the man.
Okay, don't get him started.
Okay, I'll let it go, but man, I'm going to wonder.
I have mixed feelings on his portrayal of Elrond.
You'll have to wait for our fantasy frolic to air them.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not like strong feelings or anything, but it's more of an absence of feelings.
More of a manifesto. Let me just grab it real quick.
And Natalie Portman. What do we think of Natalie Portman in this?
If I remember correctly, and I feel like Adam will fact check this, I think she won an award from the MTV Movie Awards that was something like Best On-Screen Haircut. Which, even if that didn't happen, she deserves it.
I remember it being a big deal at the time that she actually shaved her head. Like, yeah, that was a thing.
There's even a band called Natalie Portman's Shaved Head.
I do have their song Beardlust. It's a banner. I don't see anything like that on this Wikipedia page of list of accolades received by V for Vendetta. But she did win the Saturn Award for Best Actress in 2007.
That's good. We can give her the honorary Gobeski Wallace Report award for Best On-Screen Haircut of 2006.
I don't know if we can do that without further evaluation by the committee.
Nominee, then.
They don't give out Gobe Wallies just willy-nilly. You know?
That's right. And a lot of English character actors in this. Obviously, Stephen Fry.
Oh, yeah. That was a fun. Yep.
Notice Tim Pigott Smith. A lot of actors that I know from like British television and sitcoms. So like Ben Miles, I know from Coupling. He's the head of propaganda. The assistant detective plays Lestrade in the Sherlock TV series. One of the other ones, Eddie Marsden, he shows up in movies here and there. I know he's in like The World's End and things like that. So
Stephen Ray is the detective.
Yeah.
I thought his performance was pretty good.
Yeah, I almost wanted a movie that focused more on his arc. Like, in some ways, I think, again, this is kind of where it feels like the screenplay's doing something slightly different in that we're kind of invited to see V as, scripting-wise, as like an outsider. And so between Evie and Detective Inspector Finch, like between the two of them, they like sort of unravel his story. But visually, that's not what we really get on screen. And I kind of wish maybe the emphasis had been shifted a little bit more.
This is one of those movies where you could almost do another version from like his point of view.
Yeah.
But yeah, I definitely I enjoyed the performances of Stephen Ray and Natalie Portman the most. I thought they were the most interesting characters for sure.
I can't think of anyone that did like a bad job. I mean, there were no scenes where I was like, this guy or girl or person or whatever.
The
like,
butler is back. We get it. You were there when he died. This is a Spider-Man 3 reference.
Oh, yeah. I thought you were talking about this.
Like,
you met a butler. Yes. Yes. What do we think about the action in this movie? There's far enough time between a lot of the action scenes that when they came up, I was like, oh, yeah. We do get some of this in this movie.
I think it was, you know, well shot and directed and stuff like that. But again, this is, I think, kind of gets to the thing I keep saying. It was just like, because it's so visually cool, like, I think it pulls focus from what the script is trying to say.
I don't know. It felt a little separate or not as cohesive, even though I liked all those scenes a lot, you know.
But I definitely noticed the names of the John Wick guys go by in the credits on this.
Nice.
Chad Stahelski and David Leitch, however you say his name.
I guess to both of your points, I do see that there could be some value in maybe making what he's doing a little more brutal. Like, you shouldn't feel like, oh yeah, he just beat the bad guys. Maybe you should feel more like, oh no, he just disemboweled that man. Like, that man might have a family. Like, it makes everyone he fights out to be the bad guy. And I think that would bring some ambiguity back into the character, maybe to, because I don't remember who brought it up, but you know, he is going after people who he is very personally pissed off at. But there were probably ways to do that that didn't also involve ushering in a new government free age, blowing up Parliament, blowing up the Old Bailey. It feels like he has more than one purpose, but.
I mean, he's like a YouTuber, though, you know? He's on his grind set, and he's going to share it with you. You know, he wants to take you on this journey with him.
I have no idea what public. That means.
I am glad you said that, because I also do not know what a grind set is.
Well, it's like a mindset, but it's all about that grind, you know? He's putting in the work.
Yeah, it's rise and grind. It's a hustle culture.
Yeah
stuff. Yeah,
thank Phantom you Paul. Tax, mm-hmm. Gibbity toilet. Am I doing this right?
No.
So
but that's good though.
he's got a lot of riz. Check his fit.
Okay, maybe you're getting warmer. I'm not sure I fully understand it, but
he does have mad riz. I mean, I think that cannot be denied, even in the plot of the movie.
Oh yeah, no cap.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I'm done.
So I wonder if part of the reason that we have reservations about parts of this movie is because it is a movie that is made up of parts that don't always go together, where there's the cop movie, there's the love story, there's the action movie, revenge tragedy, like anti-government film, dystopic film. And I wondered when I watched it most recently if this movie would have been better if it was longer. Because this was a long film for when it came out. But now, like, we easily have stuff over 2.5 hours much more frequently. So do you think that this needed to have some of those elements removed, or that they needed to be expanded upon to make the movie react better to modern audiences?
I'm actually surprised this has not been remade as like a 6 to 8 part miniseries for HBO, particularly as noted. I mean, this came out in the Bush administration, and now we are in the second Trump administration. It feels like they could, one, absolutely get all that additional screen time to flesh out these characters. You know, I still hope sideline the love story. But, you know, you have an entire episode focused just on, you know, the detectives unearthing some of this stuff. The movie itself absolutely could have been longer. There were things that could have been cut. But I think giving this multiple hours, I mean, truly, like, you know, 6 hours to breathe across 6 episodes might be the best move. I'm sure Alan Moore would love it because he loves all adaptations of his work.
Yeah. Just to piggyback on that with two things. First thing, Alan Moore is not credited because he did not want to be credited. But there's a part of the reason for that was because apparently the producer, Joel Silver, was going around at like Comic-Con saying like, oh, yeah, like I talked to Alan Moore. He's really excited about the idea of having a movie. And Alan Moore was like, what the hell are you talking about? Absolutely not. And then it somehow came out that like Joel Silver had in fact had that conversation with Alan Moore. It had just been like 20 years earlier or something, like, oh, geez, something insane. All right. So that's just thing one. But thing two, in my like Wikipedia research, I learned that first of all, there's apparently a TV show called Pennyworth about Batman's butler that is a prequel to the Fox TV show Gotham, that but apparently is also somehow a prequel to this movie. and involves V as a character. And I really had a difficult time wrapping my head around the universe that was trying to suggest that the future Batman and this movie like coexist in a timeline somehow. And I wanted you all to go on that mental journey with me.
I mean, I could.
That's a lot to process, man.
I could see the Frank Miller Dark Knight Returns Batman being along the same timeline, sure, but nothing else.
What year was this movie supposed to? Did they state the year in the movie at any point?
At one point, I think Valerie says that before she gets arrested, around she gets arrested, it's already 2015 or something. So
I guess I don't know the Gotham timeline, but it's kind of hard to mix the American Second Civil War or whatever they were referencing with
right
Batman chasing the Riddler around Gotham. Didn't all the whatever it was published under, was that Vertigo? Like, I know all the Watchmen characters got brought into the DC universe as well. Is that?
Yes. So, okay. Actually, I think V for Vendetta, along with Watchmen, is part of the beef that Alan Moore has with DC and Warner Brothers, because it initially started in like an independent press thing, and then that folded. DC came along and said, we'll publish the rest. And according to Alan Moore, said, we will return the rights to you once it goes out of print. And he was happy about that. Apparently, according to him, not realizing that DC would simply get around this by never letting it go out of print. His collaborators, like Dave Gibbons on Watchmen and David Lloyd on this, have basically said, come on, man, you weren't that naive. You knew, you went into this eyes open like we did. So there may be some debate about how true that is versus how much just Alan Moore just was in general tired of working in those large comic companies.
So just real quick, back to Amber's question about seeing this as a miniseries. I think that was a very interesting question, because my answer is kind of yes and no. I would be very interested to see it in like a 6 to 8 part miniseries with certain aspects of it expanded on, like the cop story and V's story and Natalie Portman's story. But I, much like Gen Z, apparently, I would be also interested to see it with the attempted love story completely extracted. I think it would be much more interesting, but I would like to see some of those other characters and arcs developed further over.
Sorry to jump back, but does Gen Z not like that these relationships spring up over the course of a movie that supposedly takes place over like a week? Or does Gen Z just hate love? Like, do they state what their motivation is for not enjoying that or wanting to focus on something else?
I think given we all as millennials are uniquely qualified to talk about Gen Z's thoughts and desires. And yeah, I think they just hate love.
That's fair. Okay.
Like, so according to the article that I read about it, it's just that they value friendships and close friendships, and they want to see that represented more. Because if you look back at like historical films, it always centers a love story, and it's not like a group of friends on bicycles that are battling monsters in the 1980s. Like, Stranger Things didn't exist, like, for a lot of film history. It was always something more like The Count of Monte Cristo that centers the love story.
Gen Zers are no longer programmed to expect Aladdin and Jasmine to get together, or Hercules and Meg, and, you know, all these movies that were ubiquitous for us that we accepted, like, yep, that's how movies work.
So that's why all the movies are bad now?
That is the takeaway. Am I paraphrasing your point correctly, Amber?
That was perfect. That was perfect.
Okay.
I seem to recall criticizing Big Hero 6 as pro-STEM propaganda. So I guess you're right about the not including the love story stuff.
Love and STEM don't go together. What did we all think of the ending where they blew up Parliament? Were you like, yay? Or were you more ambivalent about Evie's ultimate choice?
It looked like they were doing either really good CGI or else a lot of model shots, and I thought visually it looked great. Big fan.
It made it easy to root for it like a victory, because presumably nobody was in the building because they all knew it was a risk. And so it was truly just sort of blowing up a symbol to kind of start a revolution or continue a revolution at that point. it made it easier to get on board with it. So I liked it.
I think it was framed very much as a hooray, a win. The reality of what would happen the next day is probably a lot darker after the government has been effectively destroyed. And I mean, the physical building obviously torn to the ground.
No, I think it's just Ewoks singing Nub Nub.
Yeah. it is
there too.
There is a positive thing that had happened, but I think the movie kind of skirts over the fact of how horrible the next like 5 to 10 years of rebuilding from tearing a government down is going to look. And I'm probably wildly underestimating that 5 to 10 year time frame.
No, man, they got the continuity of the head of state, though. It's not like they killed the queen, did they? Like, this is all just the they killed the head of government.
Yeah, was the queen ever referenced in this?
Yeah, what the state of the monarchy was here.
Huh.
If they were still nominally in charge or if it had been overthrown. I don't think the movie really says one way or the other.
Yeah, I don't think there was any reference to any kind of monarchy. Like, I became very invested in, like, which paintings were deemed illegal in the background of V's little catacomb place. And I was actually looking for like portraits of previous monarchs back there to see like, did they rewrite history or something? I don't remember seeing any though.
The only reference to the monarchy at all that I can think of was the God Save the Queen image with the chancellor on it that Diedrich had in his little cellar. It could imply some history with him and the monarchy, I guess, but really nothing explicit.
I thought it was kind of interesting though, that just the presence of that gay joke in a 2006 movie, like part of me wondered if that would fly if they were to make this remake it, let's say, as a TV series.
What joke?
Which?
God Save the Queen. So Queen is British slang for homosexual.
Oh, I guess I didn't. I mean,
it seemed once again, the text and the imagery seem to be at odds because it's very clearly the Queen with the Prime Minister's face. Or High Chancellor, I mean.
I interpreted that more as like those people who have that gigantic blow up Trump in a diaper that they take around from like city to city. Like, you know, just attacking his image. I had not even factored in the fact, I mean, and you're 100% right that Queen has a different meaning there. Even within the context of the scene, you know, with Diedrich coming out as gay. Yeah, I guess I just didn't pick that up.
Yeah, and I had read it more as an attack. Well, as an American, I read it more as an attack on his masculinity because he was presenting himself as a very like uber masculine, strong man in charge of the government.
Right. So I think by portraying him basically appearing as a woman and calling him a queen, I that's undercutting that hyper masculinity in a very British way.
I can see what you're saying, Adam, too. But I also get like Stephen Fry character. Like, the Stephen Fry character could have thought that was really funny, and that's why he has it, too.
Oh, no. I completely understand. Like, I think that's why, like, from that point of view. I don't know. I think it's just something that's very casual in this movie. I just wonder if it would be treated as casually in something made today. I think
probably
what I'm saying. Yeah. Like, standards are shifting kind of thing.
You probably might not see it. But yeah, you've got the Stephen Fry character and then the Valerie note, too. So
and Ruth.
Yeah.
And obviously the Wachowskis themselves, no stranger to that area, so yeah.
Have any of you all seen Sense8? Yeah, I ask because it has a lot of overlaps with the themes that you all are talking about in V for Vendetta. So it's like, maybe that was an attempt at making some of the ideas within V for Vendetta into a longer, like a series instead of a film.
The talk show that Stephen Fry's character hosts with the offensive skit he puts on when it's basically a Benny Hill skit.
It's a good skit.
It is just interesting, like the world that they're in and like the TV shows that are on too that you see in the background. You're like, oh, it's just a slightly different sense of humor, but you know, very British though too. And it's like, this is what he's going down for. I mean, it's kind of funny, but
well, I mean, that was what he was getting arrested for.
Right,
and then he thinks he's not killed him for.
That's true, but he thinks he's not going to get arrested for that. That's what surprises me.
Well, I think he thought he was too public a figure.
I guess, yeah.
And then oh, like they're not
mistaken.
It did seem kind of dumb, like not in the movie wise, but I'm like, okay, I guess they really are. He really is that mad about it. Just gonna haul him away immediately. Like that's not gonna have a Streisand effect.
Well, I think the idea is because it's not a democracy, a Streisand effect doesn't matter. You know, he controls the media and stuff anyway. So
yeah.
So I have a fun question to end on. How worried are you that our world will become V's world?
I'm waiting for the fun part of the question.
Yeah, that was the sarcastic bit. Maybe I'll answer first.
Sure.
I had this discussion with my kid, and it was like, well, do we have to worry about this kind of government overreach and like violence against the queer community and censorship and all of the things that V is fighting against? And I was like, no, we don't have to worry about that because this was written and made before smartphones were really a thing. And now we have smartphones and we'll be fine. And like, as I'm saying it, I'm thinking, but this is just a chunk of metal. And if we don't have connection to each other, then it would be more feasible for our society and our government to evolve into V's world.
But watching it, I think, I just wonder if we would get that feeling with any sort of dystopian narrative. Like, if we watched 1984, would we feel that way too? I mean,
guess we'll find out if someone picks it.
I guess so. The pandemic specifically, I think, is one thing that kind of connects us to what's been going on. But otherwise, it's like, you know, control of the media. And
so to me, the pandemic piece was kind of a side note. And maybe I'm just a little too close to the sun here because I live in Washington, D.C., and I'm a federal worker. And me and everybody I know have been being painted as like supervillains over the past week. And it struck me very personally. And I found it very disturbing.
Are you the supervillain? I thought you were just at the whim of supervillains.
No, I'm saying the current administration is doing everything it can to paint us like we're the worst people ever lived right now. It's a lot of the things that are sensationalized in that movie, like our reality here right now, to an extent, like it certainly feels that way to me and many people I know and work with. So it's like it struck some very personal notes with me that like if you would have asked me that question 3 months ago, I would have had a completely different answer.
Things ramped up in the last week. I think I don't want to say unbelievably quickly, but like even like those of us who were concerned about how this was going to look, I speaking only for myself, I guess I was surprised at how quickly things have escalated. The attacks on the trans community through the entire election and actions that have been taken against them just in the last like week. I mean, it is upsettingly easy to see how we could drift pretty dang close to the reality of this movie. I mean, like I said, there's judges blocking things right now. There's even some senators, they're like on the Republican Party saying, hey, notice you fired a bunch of these people, which is sort of against the law. Can you give us the justification you're supposed to give us? But will any of this hold up? A month from now, will the resolution be, no, he's not going to give you that explanation and no one's willing to stand up to this administration? Things could get worse. And yeah, I mean, this movie definitely hits wildly harder. I mean, like I said, it's quaint that this came out in the Bush administration because, like, damn, if this is what we felt like during, you know, W's, what it would have been, his second term, I guess, then, I mean, what is the equivalent of making V for Vendetta now? Like how much more dystopian would a 2025 V for Vendetta adaptation have to look to give us like the same jump from reality to fiction?
We've already got the Mad Max movies. You don't need to make new ones.
Yeah, that's true. The big old domino thing that he builds, are we thinking that was so sick. Was it CGI? Was it dominoes? Because
I think it was really
domino. It was incredible. Like, just the timing of how everything fell over. Like, I was thoroughly impressed if that was a shot they set up and got, you know, hopefully in one take, but man.
I couldn't help but picture the person who was like 80% through setting that up right, and then sneezed and was like, no!
Yeah, my family actually cheered at that part. And then I was trying to remember, like, I think we cheered at the theater too. I think that was a huge response from the audience when like we all got to see that live.
They just fell over so cleanly, like nothing was even kind of like shooting over to the side. It was beautiful.
They just don't make Domino movies like that anymore.
Damn, right? Yeah.
So, yeah, overall, like, do you think V for Vendetta holds up? Is it something you would recommend people watch still? What do we think?
I would like to see it as a mini series, and then they can throw in some corpocracy. Is that the right word, Adam? We needed more corporations trying to take over the government to make it more applicable to today's circumstances.
So you're saying you would not recommend people watch the movie?
Well, until the series comes out, you can watch the movie. And then you can also have the conversation of this is how the series is different than the movie. As you all will have a conversation in the future about how the graphic novel is different than the movie.
Okay, so thank you for the counterfactuals and everything. But just basically, would you recommend this movie still to people or not?
Yes. You want more than that? So,
well, if you want to be Scandinavian, I guess you can be.
Okay. Now, I'll say, yes, I do recommend this to people, but just brace yourself for some perhaps uncomfortable observations of our own world after you watch it.
After having just discussed it now for going on 2 hours, it's harder to say I enjoyed the movie, but like, I am glad I watched it. Just, man, like, thinking deeper and deeper about like where we're at, where we were at. It's not so much a case where it like, did it hold up? Like it, whatever, I don't want to say it aged like wine. That's a real weird thing to say about this particular movie, but like it is more relevant today than it was when it was released.
And it should be.
Yup. And I absolutely, it is worth a watch. It's imperfect. I mean, as we, you know, complained about a few little things, but like, I don't know that there's going to be a time in my life, which is, I think, a comment as much as anything on how depressingly slow progress is going to be on these sorts of fronts, that like the story that Evie reads through the toilet paper autobiography is not going to be heart-wrenching for me and just generally speaking hard to watch. It's not perfect, but very much would recommend it to anyone who hadn't seen it before. Yeah.
Yeah, I think for me, setting aside the more general, like, real world politics currently surrounding moving, just kind of approaching it as a movie, it's fine. Like I said, it's definitely, it feels like the visuals and the script are telling two slightly different stories, and I don't know that it ever quite coheres as well as you'd hope it would. But I do like that it has like those rough edges and like those tonal shifts of like, it's a, you know, it's a romance, it's an action film, it's a political thriller, it's a tragic tale of prison and love and stuff like that, like all those things kind of awkwardly mushed together, I think paradoxically somewhat make it a more interesting movie than something that would be a smoother finished product. So it's not an unreserved recommendation, but I think on the whole, yeah, it's worth watching still.
Yeah, I think it's a good movie. I think it's worth watching. The tone of it just lands much different now than it did before, perhaps. But I would recommend people watch it.
I pretty much agree with everything you guys said in that. I liked it a lot. It is kind of particularly difficult to watch at this particular point in time, but shouldn't let that stop you.
Yeah, I totally agree with Adam. It seems like the source material and the script just really lend themselves well to asking questions that the movie just doesn't actually ask at all. I really expected at some point to have like a serious discussion within the film of like, all right, is it okay to use violence to overthrow the government? Is it okay to kill people? The movie tells us, yes, it is. It's fine, right? And that's fine. If that's the type of movie they wanted to make, and that's the type of movie that we watched, and I enjoyed it. But I guess if I had known that going in, I would have enjoyed it a little bit more and not expected as much from it, I guess. But overall, I did like it. It was, you know, fun to watch. I mean, some of the kills were kind of cool, too. Again, kind of conflicting with some of the questions we wanted to ask. But yeah, I'd still say go see it.
Yeah, I thought it was a pretty fun action movie, you know, and you got to see some cool stuff about, you know, politics and whatnot, you know, made you think a little bit. The detective show stuff, you know, that sort of stuff was like, well, I mean, maybe that was a little bit more of that than I needed. But, you know, overall, just, you know, a fun and exciting story of one man's journey of self-actualization and the friends he made along the way. Well, friend he made along the way.
Very well put. So thanks, Amber, for having us watch V for Vendetta. Sounds like we all pretty much enjoyed it, although maybe some in a more abstract way than others who were reminded of current times. But we are going to move on. It's time to head to wheelofnames.com to spin the wheel. So let's find out who our next pick is coming from.
It should have been whom, by the way.
Whom's not a real word. Charlie!
Yay!
Oh, cool.
Oh, thank God. I totally forgot.
Let me look up.
Sci-fi movies. Watch.
Panic. Typing letterbox.
What current sci-fi stand for? Hold on. Okay.
Are you looking
so
up a year? Or
I'm looking up a year.
Genuinely
That's
not
it.
Prepared.
No. Okay. I was like half prepared. It's an animated movie from 2023 you can watch on Netflix called Nimona. I don't know if anyone's seen that yet. It's Oscar nominated, but I'm not sure a lot of people saw it. And it is technically science fiction. Well, not even technically. I mean, there's a lot of sci-fi in it.
What was it called? Nimona?
Yes.
Hey, this is like science fantasy.
Oh, well, it is fantasy and science fiction. It's both. It's a mishmash.
All right. Well, look, is that our first 2020s film?
It or might be.
Where was Junkhead 2020s?
Actually, I can't remember because it was kind of ambiguous what year it came out.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But maybe the earliest one was still 2020.
So.
Junkhead was 2021 per the list.
Okay.
All right. Well, thanks, Charlie, for bringing up Nimona for us to watch next time. So hope you all enjoyed this rather deep dive into V for Vendetta. And we hope you join us for future podcasts. I'm Adam Gobeski.
And I'm Charlie Wallace. Special thanks to our five guests. We had Amber Elby.
Oh, I'm supposed to say something. Sorry. Thanks for having me, everyone. It's been a pleasure. I'm also going to plug something really quick because I promised my friends that I would. I have a play coming out in Brighton, England, which is very close to the events of V for Vendetta geographically. It's called Puck in Epilogue. It's going to be playing there as part of the Brighton Fringe Festival the end of May. So if you're hearing this in England, then I guess go there. It's I wrote the script, story, and directed by Emily Carding and starring Alice Bloomer. So yeah, it's nothing like, the play is nothing like V for Vendetta. So I hope that the people who go see it still like it. And you can find us on Insta. It's at Puck in Epilogue. Puck with a P, to be clear.
How do you spell epilogue?
Oh, that's a good question. It's the American way, I think. E-P-I-L-O-G-U-E.
Mm. All right. One down, four to go.
We also had Paul Wilcox.
It was a pleasure.
Doug Gobeski.
Thanks for having me.
Dan Hess.
I'm sad now, but thank you.
And Kevin Brennvogue.
Dan said literally what I was planning on saying.
Thanks for listening. If you liked that episode, you can go to GobeskiWallaceReport.com, or we've got a lot of social media placeholder accounts. We don't post there so much, though.
Well, we all know about the downfall of Twitter, but everything exciting is on the website. Yeah, there may be a fan wiki out there somewhere. I don't know. I haven't checked recently.
Yeah, that's your job, listeners.
But you can sleep at Charlie's house.
Oh, we're back to this.
Let's pay all its own.
But one thing I just, you know, talking about this on the podcast that it reminds me of is the first time I tried a Dr. Pepper Zero Sugar Blackberry. it was a time a lot like this. I was recording a podcast. So I, you know, cracked open the purple can, took a sip and went, that's an interesting blend. I actually really like that. That's quite a delicious blackberry zero sugar. Would recommend. That's what I remember about Zero Sugar Dr. Pepper Blackberry. And the reason I bring that up is because I was recording a podcast when I first tried it. Memory is an interesting thing.
I'm confused. Are you drinking Dr. Pepper Zero Sugar Blackberry now?
Coincidentally, yes, I am.
Is it an ancient can or did it come back?
Came back, baby.
Oh.
We saw some a 12-pack at the store, and Brianne was like, well, you have to buy that, right? And I was like, well, it's a 12-pack, though. What if it's not very good? And she said, but it's buy two, get one free. And I said, yeah, you're right. So
did you pay for it, or was it one of the free ones?
I'd have to look at the receipt to determine which one was deducted, I guess.
Did it taste free? Because the best ones are the free ones.
Yeah, well, maybe it did taste free then, yeah.
To address the question asked earlier, once the soda conversation starts, that's the time to launch into the movie conversation.
Yes, take it away, Amber. Please change the subject.